So the next question, what does the platform age mean for media companies? Well, taking a step back, the larger reality for media companies is that they're no longer competing against each other, but against something completely different. There used to be a distinction between low-quality entertainment and high-quality entertainment. And high-quality entertainment would always win, because nobody in their right mind would want to watch a poorly lit video of a stranger talking to their camera for 10 minutes. But that changes if that person talking to the camera for 10 minutes is a friend of yours, or somebody from a subculture that you're interested in talking about their point of view. So I have this illustrated here on this sliding scale of production value versus personalization. The more personalized something is, the less production value it needs. A single emoji is literally the lowest production value possible. But if that single emoji is in the form of a text from a guy or a girl that you're interested in, that's extremely engaging. The less personalized something is, the higher production value it needs to be. So take the movie Avatar. That was not made for you specifically. It was made for the world. It's a huge blockbuster. But you want to see it because you want to see the spectacle. Something in the middle would be like a fishing network on TV or a YouTube star. Being entertained is becoming binary. Either you're entertained or you're not, and you can opt in any time of day, anywhere you are. And that's because social media and the platform age has enabled personalization and specialization at scale. So the next question, what happens to advertising? Well, that's the $600 billion global question that everybody's trying to figure out right now. But I think in order to understand it now, it helps to kind of go back to the past. This was the first banner ad. It debuted on October 27th, 1994, on Wired Magazine's website. And it had a 41% click-through rate, which is insane. If you know much about internet advertising now, most click-through rates are like 0.1% or less. So, but what's different between now and then to make that difference? Well, one is novelty. People probably saw this and are like, what the hell is this thing? And they clicked on it. But also, I think more importantly, is scarcity. People didn't go to that many web pages. There wasn't that much advertising, and that helps click-through rates. There is no longer scarcity when it comes to ad space on the web, and thus, there's no pricing power for publishers. So what happens to an ad-supported world where there's no scarcity? Well, two things. One, I think big media brands will do direct deals with advertisers. So let's say you're a massive publisher like Vice. You and Toyota might do some big campaign that will involve live events and TV or whatever. And then small publishers will use programmatic ads. So that's like if they make YouTube videos, it could be the remnant ads on there. It could be Facebook Instant Articles, Google AMP, basically getting other people to sell the ads for you, and you just make the content. Well, this leaves a dangerous middle ground for publishers. If you're not a huge publishing brand, but you have any significant overhead, you're going to go out of business if you're relying solely on advertising. Because advertising dollars will either go to a big brand or a platform like Google or Facebook. Furthermore, in the platform age, I feel like ads and editorial will become increasingly unbundled. In the future, ad sales and editorial may no longer be controlled by the same company at all like they have been traditionally. And why is that? Well, if you think about it, it's odd that the same people responsible for making friends also sold the ad space around it. And that behavior went to the web, where if you made the website, you also sold the ads on the page. But that's just because that's the way it was doesn't mean that's the way it will continue to be. Because of the move to platforms, there's no longer the need for the same company who made the content to be the one selling the ads around it. ESPN, for example, just might make great content, and Facebook, because it has the best first-party data and they can charge higher rates, could be the one to sell ads around it. And I think that's good for content creators, because content creators can focus on what they're good at, which is making content, and not going into advertisers' offices and trying to do deals. Next question is number five. What happens to TV? This is talked about a lot. Well, this is what a modern cable package looks like. It's a bundle of content brands and genres that you have varying degrees of interest in that you pay a monthly fee for. And I think in the future, we'll actually see something pretty similar. This is a bundle of content brands, big and small, only this time it's a little more personalized to your exact taste. And this is why I think the current TV players are actually better positioned than people give them credit for. I mean, people give them no credit, assuming they don't blow it. They already have millions of people paying monthly fees to subscribe to content brands, and a lot of them control the internet that comes into people's homes, which is a great position to be in. That said, I do see a few changes in TV going forward. One, I think that more networks, especially those without live programming, will become ad-free. I think in a world where everyone has a DVR and you're fast-forwarding anyway, you know, why not? I think interfaces will get better. I mean, think how crappy your cable box probably is. But when you're competing against Netflix and Hulu and sites with good interfaces, you need to step it up. And I also think there will be fewer shows per media brand. When you don't have to fill a 24-hour day with programming linearly and stuff's on demand, you only need a few hit shows to make a big content brand. HBO has Game of Thrones, and they kind of don't need anything else because people are so into that show. So question number six, what happens to quote-unquote quality journalism? It's a refrain you hear a lot in the age of clickbait. Well, to answer this, I think we'll go back again to how things used to be. So it used to be that fun content subsidized serious content. So in the U.S., we have a cooking segment on Today Show subsidizing Meet the Press. Newspapers, New York Times, for example, have a crossword puzzle subsidizing international war coverage. But as those two things get split apart, serious work doesn't generate the revenue that it needs to justify its expense. The stuff that advertisers want to be around is the more lighthearted, kind of sexy stuff. So how do those stories that are important to tell get told, even though they're not lucrative? Well, there are two options I see. The first is benefactors, and we've seen this in the US. Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, obviously, bought the Washington Post, and people see that as like, okay, well, he's being a custodian of the brand. Mike Bloomberg bought Business Week, and it's rumored that he also has had his eye on the New York Times for a while. So basically, people who have made a lot of money in technology, taking them over with the assurance that they will take good care of it. The other option is that old-fashioned cross-subsidization comes back, just in a slightly different form. And you see BuzzFeed doing this now, right? So this list about 90s kids has 3.8 million views. It will, dollar for dollar, it's worth it a lot more than something they would do that's serious, like the story about veterans. But what the veteran story gives BuzzFeed is a layer of credibility and gloss and class, and advertisers like to be around that. So even though it might not be directly as monetizable as the fun stuff, it still helps overall top-line revenue. And hopefully we can see more of this emerge, because I think it's a good thing. So the last question, number seven, how can a media company survive and thrive in the platform age? Well, the good news is that there's no better time, I believe, than right now to start a content business. You just have to do it right. And that doesn't mean it's easy to sustain, but the gatekeepers just aren't there anymore to prevent you from starting it. And new platforms are emerging every day that are land grabs. With College Humor, we have one of the biggest comedy channels on YouTube with 11 million subscribers. And we would not be able to be at that level that we are right now had we not gotten early, gotten beachfront real estate, and started collecting subscribers. Platforms are really rich-get-richer platforms, or rich-get-richer environments. And if you get in early, it always helps. I feel like Facebook Live could be that environment now. Snapchat could be that environment. As big as Snapchat is, it still could be in its early days. I think the key in the platform age is to think of to build content and build a platform for build a media brand for the world we live in today. And if you think about it, it's kind of like a restaurant. Consumers used to go directly to your restaurant, right? That was the direct era in the 90s. After that, they'd select your restaurant from Seamless or a guide online, and then they'd pick you. That was the referral era. But now they go to a food festival, and like outside, and you're one of countless vendors all vying for their attention. And I think with the third one, where we are now, if you win, you can win big. I mean, you see how long the lines are for the most popular stuff at the food festival. On ad-supported digital media, I would offer two rules. The first, don't start a purely ad-supported digital media business. And rule number two, if you're tempted to start an ad-supported digital media business, see rule number one. Just because you have an audience, and this is something a lot of people don't understand, just because you have an audience doesn't mean you'll make enough money on advertising alone to sustain a business. That's not to say all internet businesses with an advertising opponent are a bad strategy. It just needs to be part of a bigger strategy. Think of your media brand as a funnel. Use the ad-supported component at the top of the funnel to get people in. Maybe you'll run that at break-even or even at a loss. Then you have below commerce. The Chive is a great brand that uses commerce. They sell t-shirts and beer, and they do make a lot of money doing it. Or subscription. Crunchyroll, which I'm sure a lot of you know, is anime. And people, say 750,000 people, pay $5 a month to see anime, and it's a great business. And I think that's because there are riches in niches. Here are three examples. Skift is travel. Travel site, they make money from conferences. Rooster Teeth is gaming. They do commerce and events and subscriptions, a community. The Information is a tech publication. Just started recently. It's already profitable. People pay $40 a month to get that tech news. Another source of revenue when you're an expert in a genre is to sell that expertise. We did that with Coca-Cola, with one of our brands called Dorkly. Coca-Cola was starting an esports initiative on their social media, and they came to us and they said, you guys know about esports, why don't you make content? And we did, and very quickly it rose to be the second most followed Twitter handle at all of Coke. And this is something that a media company can do, but a general ad agency cannot, because an ad agency can't afford to have staffs, editorial staffs, fluent in every single genre, but a media company, obviously, that's what they do all day. Expertise in a genre is becoming increasingly valuable to advertisers, because in the platform age, it's too risky to have non-experts commenting on areas of passion for consumers. And this hit me a few months ago, and I call it the Red Lobster problem. For those of you unfamiliar, Red Lobster is a seafood chain. It's based in the US, but they have locations all around the world. And the next part may sound like a non sequitur, but it's not. In February, Beyonce released a new song called Formation, in which she referenced Red Lobster in the lyrics. The company responded 8 hours later with an innocuous tweet. Seems pretty harmless. What happened after that? Outrage. People were furious. They were like, Red Lobster, this was your one, Beyonce mentioned you, and this was your one chance, and you had 8 hours, and this was the best you could do? Well, this is the CEO of Red Lobster. His name is Ken Lopdrop. If you would have told this guy 2 years ago that his seafood restaurant would have to be ready with the perfect and instantaneous response to a surprise Beyonce album, he would look at you like you were crazy. But now the reality is different, and we're living in the platform age. And if you get called on, you better have a great answer. Thanks.